coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
Your new collab is taking mescaline through FDA right now. And, you know, it's important to understand that mescaline is the main alkaloid of peyote as well as San Pedro and other cacti. But we acknowledge the spiritual and cultural implication of that, right? And so acknowledging that there is this threat to peyote, that mescaline is a part of peyote, we feel a responsibility. And so through that, what we've done is really created reciprocity through the Journey Reciprocity Trust and our consultation process. And so the Journey Reciprocity Trust is really designed to ensure fair and equitable sharing of benefits with Indigenous groups that participate within the ecosystem as it relates to peyote. And so really supporting conservation efforts, really supporting access to mental health, supporting the value creation that is happening within the space and making sure that we're directing it at the communities that have protected the medicine for time immemorial, who have protected these ways of being and knowing and the traditions that come forth. And it is my true belief that we would not be here in the psychedelic renaissance at this time if it wasn't for the Indigenous peoples who fought so hard to ensure that we could practice our traditions.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Today's episode is actually a repost from my own personal podcast. I do a podcast called Life is a Festival, where I interview cultural pioneers about living a more open-hearted life. Well, today's guest, Sutton King, lives a life full of joy and service, and she is also the head of impact at Journey Collab, a major psychedelic drug development company. Journey Collab just raised $12 million, and Sutton's important work in reciprocity is a major part of the company's appeal to value-aligned investors. In fact, she has a lot to teach us all about the lessons of reciprocity from her people, which is why I chose to share this podcast with you today. On the show, we explore Sutton's commitment to healing and service, from her early days dancing jingle dress to her work with the Urban Indigenous Collective in New York. Sutton explains her perspective on kinship and the Seven Generations Principle. We discuss Journey Collab, the psychedelic startup that is developing mescaline for treating alcoholism. Finally, we review the responsibilities of psychedelic entrepreneurs as well as individual psychonauts to be in right relation with the honorable harvest. A descendant of the Menominee and Oneida Nations of Wisconsin, Sutton King is a nationally recognized Indigenous health advocate, researcher, and social entrepreneur. She is the co-founder and president of Urban Indigenous Collective, a nonprofit advocating on the behalf of urban natives in the tri-state area. She is head of impact at Journey Collab, which is a startup led by Sam Altman and Jishan Chaudhry, developing psychedelic treatments for mental health. And she's the co-founder of Shock Talk, a culturally tailored telemental health platform that facilitates culturally appropriate patient-provider relationships. Sutton's life is a festival, and it's also one devoted to the best parts of psychedelic medicine. So please enjoy this episode with Sutton King. I'm so excited to have the opportunity to speak about your life and your work and to speak about reciprocity and what reciprocity means in the psychedelic landscape and in our own lives. So there's a lot to discuss today, and I'm just very honored that you're taking the time to be here with me. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. And I'll say Poso, Shukoli, Sutton King, Nyukyats, Natao Pinuki, Ungwehwe Ni'i, Magneta Noigitolota, Oniota Aga Ni'i. So hello, that's a greeting in my Oneida language, where I share that I'm Oneida, I'm of the Turtle Clan, people of the Standing Stone. My names are Sutton King, which are, it's my English name, but my native name is Noctow Pinuki, and that means comes first woman.
Wow, comes first woman. That is a powerful
powerful name. How do you feel that that's manifesting in your life in this precise moment? Do you feel really resonant with that name right now?
Absolutely. I think throughout my life, it's been a theme, being able to do a lot of firsts in my family, which I have a lot of gratitude for, being one of the first to receive a master's in my family, being one of the first to move so far away to New York City. And especially right now, being, you know, one of the first and being a voice to really bring together, I think, these different ways of being and knowing within the mainstream psychedelic space, not to discredit any of my ancestors or those who come before me. But it's very unique, I think, in the way that I've been given the opportunity to speak about where we're at as a collective being as it relates to plant medicine and the psychedelic space.
And could it be that you might be the first in your lineage to do consulting work for the United Nations or to have a piece about you in the New York Times, maybe to have your own nonprofit, to be working with a psychedelic drug development company? It seems like there's a lot of firsts that I don't think many of our listeners have had any access to in their lives. So you have quite the CV for someone who is still also in some ways early in your career with a lot ahead of you.
Absolutely. And I would say that I'm definitely someone who's done a lot of firsts in my family, but a lot of my inspiration comes from my ancestors and my family members. You know, in particular, my relative Ingrid Washington-Talk, Flying Eagle Woman. She was taken from us in 1999, but she was one of the first members of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues within the United Nations. She started the Four Directions Fund and did a lot of work really bringing together both the Indigenous peoples of the North and the Indigenous peoples of the South. And she was unfortunately assassinated in Colombia doing work with the Indigenous peoples there. But it really is her legacy that has inspired me in so many things that I do, whether it's moving to New York City. She was actually one of the first to move to New York City and start the work that she did here in community with the American Indian Community House. And to really look at her legacy and the work that she did and the way that she brought our teachings of the Menominee people to mainstream, if you will, was really profound to me. And I really felt like I had an opportunity to continue those teachings and continue on that path as if the baton was passed to me. You know, and it was also learning about her assassination that really, you know, I would say inspired me to learn more about gender-based violence as it relates to Indigenous women, apart from my own story as a survivor. But I really see Ingrid's work as a testimony to just the teachings of the Menominee people, as well as my grandfather, Chief Oshkosh, who really, I think, set the precedence as it relates to sustainability. And we can get into that more later.
Oh yeah, there's so much to get into there and so many legacies and so much to honor as well. You know, I will often start in a conversation like this with your story, but I think that before we talk about your story, I think just to locate our audience in the work that you're doing in this moment, we'll talk a lot about this later on, but this idea of reciprocity in the context of the modern psychedelic movement. Many of the listeners to this podcast are folks who have experienced a great deal of personal transformation through their access to psychedelic medicine. And so just before we launch into this winding journey that is taking you to where you are now, what's a day look like for you right now in terms of the work that you're doing? What are some of the things, some of the projects that you're working on? Just give us a little bit of a taste of what the actual labor of making change in the world in the psychedelic space looks like for someone like yourself right now?
Sure. So I would have to start with, I'm the co-founder and president of the Urban Indigenous Collective, which is a nonprofit that advocates on the behalf of urban natives living in the tri-state area. So really looking at the importance of culturally appropriate healthcare and culturally appropriate mental healthcare resources for urban natives living in metro cities. We know that there's a lot of lack of healthcare infrastructure as it relates to Indigenous peoples. And then on the other hat, I am the head of impact at Journey Co-Lab, which is a drug development company led by Sam Altman and Jishan Chaudhary, and we're developing psychedelic treatments for mental health. And then last but not least, I'm the co-founder of Shock Talk, which is a culturally tailored telemental health platform that truly facilitates culturally appropriate patient-provider relationships. And so within all of that, I would really say, you know, in a short way to describe myself, I'd say I'm an Indigenous health advocate, I'm a researcher, and I'm a social entrepreneur at heart. And I'd say a typical day looks like, for me, it would be looking at access and benefit sharing within the psychedelic sector, really looking at how we are including Indigenous peoples and the value creation that the Renaissance is really lying forth. And day to day, I'm thinking about ways that folks in the space can show up for Indigenous peoples who've been oftentimes alienated from the wealth that's being generated. I'm strategizing with folks on how we can create a trust that can support conservation, that can support access to mental health, that can support the larger ecosystem, making sure that the folks, the culture, the community who has protected and stewarded this medicine aren't left behind, and that their knowledge and traditions are centered. I would say on the grassroots level, I am advocating for resources here in what we call Lenape Hoking, New York City. One of the largest populations of urban natives lives here. And unfortunately, we just don't have the resources we need. And so as I'm watching the psychedelic sector start to commercialize these medicines and a lot of wealth being generated and value being created, you know, I think about the grassroots nonprofits folks like myself, where I come from, and the resources that we're so that we're fighting over. To be quite frank, there's just not enough philanthropic donations going to Indigenous led organizations, and so really looking at a way in which this value is being created in the space to really give back to these different organizations, nations, traditions, cultures, to protect them, to empower them, and to make sure that they have the right tools to advocate for themselves as well. On one hand, I'm making sure that I'm teaching the sector about the things that they can do to operationalize reciprocity, if you will. And on the other hand, I'm trying to ensure that Indigenous peoples also know their rights as it relates to their own plant medicine and traditions. And so really, I'd say a moccasin on one foot and a high heel on the other. How do we keep the balance?
Well, Sachin, we are so lucky to have you in the work that you're doing. And I love the way you've laid out these different access points you have to supporting mental health in these underserved communities in New York City. And then the big drug development company, which, as you know, I hold Journey Collab in high esteem because I believe that they are in right relation in a way that many companies in the psychedelic space are not. So, you know, as you pointed out, there's just this wide spectrum of ways that you're contributing. And I think also a way that you're contributing to is just as a model for other women, for other people of color, for people generally in the psychedelic space. Like, I see you as a model and as a leader. And part of what my hope is today in this conversation is to really just show you, in addition to talking about something as meaty and important as operationalizing reciprocity, I can't wait for you to tell me how to do that, because we need that. But also, like, how does a life blossom into what yours is now, where you're so involved and so engaged, and you have so many different ways in which you're contributing? It strikes me that you're going to need to really cultivate a lot of joy in your service to have just the wherewithal and the energy to do the work you do. So I'm curious how you evolved into this being of service who's able to work on so many projects at once with so much passion while maintaining what I witness as a lot of joy. Can you tell me a bit about, like, the earliest kernels of the visions that then blossomed into the work you do in the world?
Absolutely. I'll start with, I've always been deeply connected to my Indigenous culture, traditions. My mother, who was born in the 70s, born to a grandmother, my maternal grandmother, she's enrolled in the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. She's both Menominee and Oneida. My grandmother grew up in a time where it was not cool to be a Native American, or she would say it wasn't cool to be an Indian. And coming from generations of boarding school era, my grandmother, I'd say, went through different ways of assimilation. And there was not a lot of ceremony within my mom's life while she was growing up. And born in the 70s, it was very important for her to reclaim that tradition. Although my family grew up on the reservation, still lives on the reservation, there are families who are seen as more traditional natives and those who are perhaps more religious through Catholicism. And so with my mom, with me growing up, it was so important for her to remind me of the ancestry that I come from, of the teachings that we were born with, these ways of knowing and being. And so my early education was spent in the Oneida Daycare on the Oneida Reservation. I was born in Green Bay, which shares a border with the Oneida Reservation, whereas the Menominee Reservation is 45 minutes north. But again, all my family born on our ancestral land. But my mom really wanted me again to always know where I come from, no matter where I might be in the world. And so ceremony was always something that was a part of my life. And so I grew up dancing what is known as jingle dress. And the jingle dress dancing really represents healing, right? We dance for our relatives and our community and our nations who are sick and need that healing. And so I started dancing at a very young age, probably about 2 years old. I was actually walking at 8 months and I was dancing around that time. So probably even sooner, actually. And I didn't know then what it truly meant to dance jingle dress. But as an adult, I realized that that calling to healing and that purpose was instilled very early. And I always had this purpose in my heart that it was my calling to help heal my community. Matter of fact, when I was first born, my mom brought me to our reservation and an elder actually came to me and said to my mother that this little girl will do great things for her people. And it wasn't until way later that my mom shared that story with me. But, you know, I never knew exactly what it would look like. But in some way, creator and ancestors have truly paved the way for me to really be able to walk in that. And so at 17 years old, I decided I was coming to New York City to begin walking on that path and really excited to be able to be here today so early in my career and have done so many different things to support the healing of Indigenous communities.
Mm-hmm. That's so beautiful. Can you describe what the actual dance that you would do, what it looked like?
Yeah.
How could we visualize that dance?
Absolutely. And so the dress is really laid with layers of cones. And as you step, the cones shake and they produce a beautiful, beautiful song, really. And really it's a variation of different two steps, hops, where you have one hand on each side and your chest to the sky, almost your heart to creator, you really are moving to the sound of the drum. And it is truly powerful. And I always thought it was truly majestic. And again, really felt such deep connection and such power within the jingle dress dancing.
It sounds so powerful and majestic. I love mm-hmm. that. I'm so glad that you were able to describe that for us. Okay, so you arrive in New York City and ready to take a bite out of the Big Apple, ready to make your mark. And I understand that you became very passionate about Indigenous health in an urban context. Was that something that you started getting into working in nonprofits in the context of also your studies at that time?
Well, let me walk back a couple steps here. So I'd always lived in more rural or suburban places, whether it was outside of the Oneida Reservation, outside the Menominee Reservation. It wasn't until I was 15 that I moved to what I had considered a big city, which was Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the biggest city I had ever seen by far. And when I got there, I actually was approached by a group called Urban Underground. And they had a table outside of my high school and they were talking about equality and racial injustice and the school to prison pipeline. And I'm, what? what is going on here? You know, I need to understand what this group is about. And I signed up to learn more information, and it was application process where I think maybe 800 folks, urban inner city youth, applied to be a part of a program called Urban Underground. I was, I think, one of 30 who got admitted into this organization. And it really was this organization to support young leaders within urban settings to really create social justice campaigns and equity campaigns around providing more resources and strengthening community. Well, I found my place, didn't I? And I just really started to shine. They saw a leader in me before I did. And that's Reggie and Charlene Moore, who are great advocates, community leaders in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And that's really where Sutton found her voice. I was organizing buses to skip school to go to the Capitol and in Wisconsin to protest and march with some of the greatest leaders of the civil rights movement. And so when I really had this calling at 17 to move to New York City. Well, my family thought I was, you know, crazy. You know, I had never been there before. But I knew that the work that Ingrid had done and this really voice inside of me was really pointing me in that way, in that direction. And so I applied to a variety of universities. I don't think my mom believed that I was truly going to go until I got all those acceptance letters. And I showed her and she said, okay, well, let's pack up the car. And so my mother, my mom, me, three Native women packed the car up and drove from Wisconsin to New York City. It was about, I think, 17 hours in that car, but well worth it. And they dropped me off at the College of Mount St. Vincent in the Bronx in Riverdale. It sits on 70 acres on the Hudson, kind of tucked away. Not exactly what you would think of a New York City university, but it was really a good transition for me coming from, you know, my grandparents who had a 180-acre dairy farm in Wisconsin, which is where I grew up as a country girl, really, but to really dive into psychology. You know, I pursued my degree in psychology. I really wanted to better understand the historical and intergenerational trauma of my community. You know, here I was fighting on the grassroots to get resources in inner city Milwaukee. But why are we needing resources? Why is there a lack of? Why is it when I'm in Shorewood, which was a nice suburban city of Milwaukee, there's a lot of resources and there's a lot of great programs and there's a lot of great things to do. But when I go into Milwaukee or I go home to my reservation, there's nothing. So this really began my deep introspection into self and into my family's heritage and lineage. Mm.
And we've talked prior to this conversation a bit about that heritage and that lineage. And I'd love to speak a little bit about that now, particularly through this theme that's kind of running through the entire conversation, which is about real reciprocity and a real balance of communities and ecosystems. And so in this moment when you're studying psychology in New York and you're starting to imagine your mark that you'd like to make on the world, I'm curious, you just mentioned that this was a time when you started to look more deeply into your lineage and into some of the teachings. What were some of the teachings that came from your lineage that really started to bubble up and guide your way in that particular moment in your life?
Yeah, I would say that kinship, which is really at the center of many of our indigenous teachings, which is, again, this really shared traditional cultural value that really requires all things animate and inanimate to be good relatives, to work within relation with one another to achieve harmony and sustainability. These are the ways in which I've always saw the world. And I think that within this indigenous worldview, kinship really is, I think, the bedrock to what contemporary world has coined as, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. But I always felt so blessed to know these teachings and to know that if we are going to truly achieve a just and sustainable world, that we have to operate in a framework and view of kinship, and that we have to protect one another. And realizing that, you know, I'm here because of kinship. I'm here because of these sacred teachings that have guided my ancestors through the violence of colonialization and exploitation to survival. And so I think the teachings that taught them are the teachings that I would want to, you know, pass on to future generations, which is another teaching that we can talk about, also the seven generation principle.
Oh yeah, let's talk about seven generations, because that comes up a lot in psychedelic circles. Share a little bit about that, because I don't think that I've ever heard about this concept closer to the source. It's mostly come down through the kind of geeky psychedelic people. Which I'm not saying you're not a geeky psychedelic person. I'm not saying you aren't.
But truths can exist at once.
Yeah, exactly. Tell me about the seven generations.
Yeah, so to tell you about this, the seven generations, is important to tell you about my Oneida ancestry. So as I share, my grandmother is enrolled in the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. But the Oneidas are ancestral to New York. And the Oneidas actually were given land by the Menominees after we were being encroached on. So some stayed here in New York, some migrated to Wisconsin. And so the Oneidas were really in a lot of intertribal warfare and with a lot of different tribes within northern New York. So the Mohawk, the Onondaga, the Seneca. And it was really westward expansion that really brought six New York nations together, which is known as the Haudenosaunee, or the Six Nations, or you know, some of us call Six-Nay. But really, we had to come together in unity to really protect one another. And so this principle of the seven generation is something that was really considered heavily. It's really this philosophy that the decisions that we make today need to result in a sustainable world seven generations into the future. And this is integral to Haudenosaunee life, you know, and it's this really, I think, concrete value that strengthens and deepens our bond of community while promoting sustainability. And even in business structures for Native people, and the way that we govern and the way that we interact with stakeholders. And I think it goes back to just looking at our democracy. The Iroquois Confederacy actually holds the oldest democracy on earth. And it was actually the United States Constitution that based a lot of the concepts on the Haudenosaunee way of life. And I think it was 1988 that the U.S. Senate actually honored the Iroquois Confederacy with a resolution that highlighted that the original 13 colonies were really influenced by the political system that was developed by my people. And so, you know, there's a lot of different ways in which Indigenous values and ways of being and tradition are tied into the world we live in today, whether that's the seven generation principle or it's the way in which we think about kinship and our sustainable business structures or the way that we govern. They come down to very simple teachings of being good relatives to one another and caring for one another.
The way that I have heard about seven generations has been around transformational psychedelic work being something that heals seven generations in the past and seven mm-hmm. generations to the future. And perhaps this is part of the seven generations teaching that you're referring to, but it's interesting that that's the piece that seems to trickle down through psychedelic communities. But this idea of stewardship, governance, and reciprocity, that piece isn't as highlighted. And it's interesting because it does seem to maybe represent a little bit of the kind of individualistic perspective that is pretty endemic in Western culture, that I'm doing my healing for my lineage, but it's a little bit more me doing my thing, which I see a lot in the psychedelic community, versus me taking on responsibility and me owning a responsibility that I have that is maybe more widespread. So that's I think right. That's an interesting distinction.
Yeah. And I think it's one of our responsibilities as human people to find ways to enter into reciprocity more than the human world, right? And that's kinship, as I talked about, both animate and inanimate. And I think we can do that through a number of things, whether it's gratitude, ceremony, really understanding the traumas and the challenges that came before us that our ancestors experienced. And I think that a lot of the current challenges that we have is because folks aren't understanding the interconnectedness of human and natural systems. And I think when they start to center kinship and understand that, they'll understand that this responsibility is more than just this individual view. It's greater than us. It's seven generations. It's the ancestors who came before us and those who will come after us. So that responsibility and accountability, I look at as very sacred and deep to me. And so you asked earlier how this has transformed me and my calling. Holding these ways of being and knowing and these principles have always informed the work in which I decide to align myself with, which takes care of my heart and my joy.
Mm. And there's one psychedelic plant for me that is symbolic of the issue with the individual consumptive version of psychedelic transformation versus the necessity for deeply interrelated reciprocity. And that is peyote. Peyote is, to my understanding, the most endangered of all psychedelic plants. It takes a very long time to mature a peyote button. Peyote is endangered not just because of consumption through ceremony, but also because of developments in the Southwest. These are precious little cacti that we can't rapaciously consume for our own sort of egoic transformation outside of the context in which they're appropriate. Meanwhile, it's my understanding, and you may know more about this than me, I know that this isn't directly related to your people, or perhaps in some ways it is, but that peyote did bring together a lot of different indigenous groups and brought a lot of leadership there. So it's this powerful little cactus button that, frankly, we shouldn't be just doing. You shouldn't just be eating peyote. And for me, it's in a sense kind of symbolic of some of the contradictions that exist in the sort of psychonaut, self-experimentation, individualistic perspective versus the deep indigenous lineages that have been stewards. And I think it's a great thing for us to talk about, in part too, because of what's going on with Journey Collab as well and Journey Collab's exploration of mescaline. So let's talk a little bit about peyote. So first, I just want to see if I was right about this, because I made the statement, it was not my understanding that peyote was used by your people. Is that accurate?
That's right. So yeah, not home to the Menominee or the Oneida people, but there's definitely accounts and documentation of the different bartering paths, whether those are the different trails or rivers where a lot of these medicines were traded. And peyote did bring a lot of different indigenous groups together of the North and the South. And I think a lot of plant medicine has shown that historically to bring folks together, which is very beautiful.
Well, let's talk about this magical button that brings people together. And if there's one thing that I'd love for our listeners to take away from this, well, I'd love for them to take away everything and exactly what is most relevant to them. But if there's one thing that is present for me is the idea that we need to be very wise about our consumption of psychedelic plants and what the context we're using them for. And I think our own personal transformation is not enough. It's not enough to say, I want to have a groovy trip and I want to ascend and become a better entrepreneur. We're not quite hitting the mark there. So let's talk a bit about that. How might one approach peyote? How is Journey Collab approaching peyote and mescaline?
Absolutely. And this is a really important conversation that we're having right now. And Journey Collab is taking mescaline through FDA right now. And, you know, it's important to understand that mescaline is the main alkaloid of peyote as well as San Pedro and other cacti. But we acknowledge the spiritual and cultural implication of that, right? To be able to say, oh, it's just mescaline. It's just this compound, it has nothing to do with peyote, is a very reductionist view, right? This individualistic view that I think the Western world has centered and really take steps back from looking at kinship, right? And looking at the interconnectedness of things, right? And so acknowledging that there is this threat to peyote, that mescaline is a part of peyote, we feel a responsibility. And so through that, what we've done is really created reciprocity through the Journey Reciprocity Trust and our consultation process. And so the Journey Reciprocity Trust is really designed to ensure fair and equitable sharing of benefits with Indigenous groups that participate within the ecosystem as it relates to peyote. And so really supporting conservation efforts, really supporting access to mental health, supporting just the value creation that is happening within the space and making sure that we're directing it at the communities that have protected the medicine for time immemorial, who have protected these ways of being and knowing and the traditions that come forth. And it is my true belief that we would not be here in the psychedelic renaissance at this time if it wasn't for the indigenous peoples who fought so hard to ensure that we could practice our traditions, whether that was the ghost dance, sun dance in ceremony, or practicing with our different plant medicines. And so I see this trust as a way of reciprocity and a way to really ensure that indigenous peoples, as well as other folks in the community who have really, again, advocated for this use within indigenous peoples, it remains that way.
I really like Journey Collab. And the reason is and as you pointed out, is there's two things going on here. Is one, looking at synthetic mescaline moving through FDA approval. So not harvesting from peyote.
Right.
So these are medicines that are going to be created in a sustainable way. That's huge.
Yes.
And then what you've just so eloquently described here, the reciprocity trust. What are the actual numbers here in terms of the equity structure of the trust itself, and who does that trust actually support? Where does that money ultimately go?
Right. So there's actually 10% of equity that is in the Journey Reciprocity Trust. And the Journey Reciprocity Trust is really to ensure that Indigenous communities, as well as a larger ecosystem, is a part of the value that Journey Collab is creating. And so the goal of the trust really is to equitably distribute the benefits arising out of mescaline and to support conservation. We talked about the threat of peyote, so this is a way in which we can really support the conservation ecology of peyote, as well as access to mental health resources. So, you know, we've talked about just the lack thereof of culturally appropriate resources, especially as someone who has a nonprofit, and the importance of just making sure that there's money coming back into these vital resources. And so this trust really serves as a mechanism of reciprocity.
So I'm reading this great book right now called Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And in Braiding Sweetgrass, she's writing about the honorable harvest. And she has this section about someone who is a trapper. And she's like, I thought that I would never be cool with someone who traps animals. And then she goes into this sort of this deep journey of this man's life. And he developed this relationship that was kind of like conservation and trapping at the same time. So he would actually feed the mothers to help, they'd have more offspring, and then they would trap the males. But if they trapped a female, they would know that the numbers had gone off and they'd have to stop trapping. And I was reading that and it made me think a little bit about what is possible for the psychedelic community now. If people with a lot of resources weren't falling in love with ayahuasca, those people might not be donating money to rainforest preservation, mm-hmm. right? There is an opportunity here for people who've been turned on and lit up by these medicines, particularly medicines that often connect us more deeply with the earth. There's an opportunity here. However, we got to get that right because it's so easy to create more extraction. And
right.
I think that the biggest failure of the psychedelic renaissance would be for the greatest paradigm shift in mental health to actually fall into the same extractive patterns that we've seen with all these other kind of capitalist models.
Right.
So when we're looking at Journey Collab and the Reciprocity Trust and the work that you're doing there, it's not just what that one company is doing, it's the model. Can we show that a stakeholder model isn't high risk, and can that get the investment capital in while creating this trust itself? So the stakes are so high, and I think that's why it's so important that we're talking about, and so important that we're having models like Journey Collab that we can extrapolate out to the broader psychedelic renaissance and the broader psychedelic community.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for the Menominee people, this principle of sustainability really comes from just, I think, our historical and cultural relationship with the land. You know, my grandfather, as I talked about, Chief Oshkosh, he really understood the importance of culture and tradition as just the foundation of survival and sustainability for our nation, at least. And I think that him understanding the need to protect culture and our tradition, and him understanding this, but also knowing that the world was changing, right? People could own land. We never understood that. And as that was happening, we were having to seed our land, our acres slowly. He did this in a very strategic way, but to me, it really exemplified this bridge of two worlds in which I find myself walking on a lot. And I think that his ability to do this, his ability to understand the importance of culture and land and what was happening in the contemporary world then, allowed for me to stay connected to my teachings, right? And to for our people to stay on our ancestral land where a lot of us are displaced. And I think that it's that relationship with the forest and his teachings. He really taught the Menominee people to never take more than what we needed. His teachings are recognized globally today as sustainable forestry. People, as a matter of fact, come from all over the world to look at the Menominee forest and to look at the way in which we have protected our forest, really making sure that we never take again more than we need. And it was the sick trees, the trees that had fallen, that we took. And I just share that because I think that, again, it's these simple teachings that could really create so much change and really, really bring forth this way that we're thinking about equality, the way that we're thinking about equity, the way that we're thinking about innovative business structures that ensuring that we are being fair and we're being equitable. I go back to the teachings of just the Plains people who were one of the greatest honors was giving your horse to the poorest member of the tribe. Or I think about the Pacific Northwest folks who practiced the potluck, right? And it was really this voluntary redistributing of wealth to make sure that those who have the least are able to eat. And I think that while we're in this, you know, a psychedelic renaissance, we really need to go back to these teachings and really ensure that we are taking care of the folks who, again, have been left out. And so it's really great to hear you really talk about the way in which, you know, there are folks who have more resources who are coming into community with these medicines in a respectful way, or I hope they are, and the responsibility that they have to ensure that, you know, the medicines that they consume or share with their community are protected, or the people and traditions in which it comes from are protected. And there are a number of ways to do that. And I'm just really honored that we're talking about that now and that there's such a warm embrace from the ecosystem to look at these innovative structures. And again, a lot of them come from these basic principles and teachings of the Haudenosaunee or many other Indigenous peoples.
Okay, so I'd like to speak to two audiences. So first, I'd like to speak to the people who are involved in the psychedelic movement from a business perspective. And then I'd like to speak to the individual psychonauts, the people who are participating in these medicines, the people who are having these experiences themselves. So in the first group, I don't just mean the big business. I also mean psychedelic therapists. I also mean anyone who is making a livelihood around psychedelic transformation. That's the first group who we're going to talk to. And then the second group are people who are having the transformation themselves. So with the first group, mm-hmm. we've talked about Journey Collab as a model. Mm-hmm. We've talked about some of the concepts. I'd like to bring in also the Nagoya Protocol in our conversation. So I'd love for you to explain that, as well as free, prior, and informed consent, two concepts that I'd love for you to explain for us in this context. And I think that for anyone who is making a living on psychedelic transformation, what I'd love to hear from you is, what do they need to know? What are the key points of reciprocal right relationship with Indigenous lineages that we need to bring in as those of us who are making a living, as well as giving the healing to others?
Yeah, let's start with the Nagoya Protocol, right? I think that what's so beautiful about the United Nations and about the Indigenous peoples and leaders who came before us is that they've designed so many different protocols and declarations. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. Indigenous peoples have been coming together to advocate for how they want to be in community with folks and how they see reciprocity. And so let's take a look at those things. And so starting with the Nagoya Protocol, right? The Nagoya Protocol is an international agreement or a multilateral treaty. A treaty can be a little bit of a scary word for Indigenous peoples because there's oftentimes than not, treaties are broken, these sacred promises. But there is this agreement that covers biodiversity and the application of benefits that are arising from use. And so, again, as you see with Journey Collab, we are inspired by the Nagoya Protocol, right? Really seeing that with us taking mescaline through FDA, this responsibility to support the conservation of peyote. And so I think that it's up to the company or the person in what level of access benefit sharing that they are able to engage in or willing to engage in. But I do think that that is something that should be set. For a lot of folks, say again, they see access benefit sharing as synonymous to reparations. But I think that this is a way in which we can really start creating some equity in the space. And so starting there, I think that it's important that those conversations are being, you know, being had with Indigenous peoples about the use of those medicines, synthetic or not. And so starting there with Nagoya Protocol, I say access benefit sharing is the number one thing that you can do to show up because we need resources.
And then there's also this free, prior, and informed consent, which I think is really important. We often talk about cultural appropriation as something that we'd like to avoid in the psychedelic space. But rather than avoiding cultural appropriation, I think this concept of free, prior, and informed consent, when we're talking about the prior consultation and participation of Indigenous peoples in projects that impact their resources, that this is like a key feature as well. There's got to be a way that it works even on the smaller individual levels of psychedelic therapy, for example.
Absolutely. It's important to understand what free, prior, and informed consent is, or FPIC. It's really aimed at just establishing a bottom-up participation and consultation with Indigenous peoples prior to beginning any development on ancestral land or using resources in Indigenous populations' territory. And that comes from the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, UNDRIP. Shout out to Jesse Hudson. We always say respect the drip when we talk about this work. And I think it's really important to highlight that. But Journey Collab really, I'd say, is inspired by FPIC as well. And we're really looking at that within our consultation. And so, you know, I think that it's important to highlight the most ethical and de-risked approach is learning from the communities who have created safe containers for time immemorial. And I think this consultation that you do with community supports that fair and equitable distribution of benefits that arise from whatever portion of your business. And asking Indigenous peoples, what does reciprocity look like to you? That happens within consultation. And I think it's really ignorant to assume that we know what reciprocity looks like for each group or individual or medicine. It's important to have many conversations and create a safe container to have a meaningful dialogue. And that's really this precedence that the free, prior, and informed consent creates, is this seven-step pathway to have meaningful dialogue in a way that respects Indigenous peoples. And FPIC is really a free prior. So it's really important to make sure that these conversations are happening before you decide to do anything on ancestral land or within ancestral medicine.
So something about this prior piece here, having these conversations, bringing in these different stakeholders, is something that may have not already happened for certain companies. There's companies who are wanting to, quote, diversify their boards, for example. Mm-hmm. There are different organizations, maybe people listening to this podcast who may be running an organization who hasn't quite done this prior engagement of Indigenous voices.
Never too late.
And so that can be, but it can be intimidating. Who do you talk to? Mm-hmm. And is it offensive for someone to say, well, look, I got a board of white businessmen. I realize there's something wrong here. I want to create a different psychedelic model, but I don't just want to be going around trying to tokenize whoever's on a psychedelic panel and be like, oh, I'm going to go approach them and be like, hey, can you be on my board so that I can look like I'm making the difference that I want to make. And at the same time, people do want to make that difference. So it's this tricky place of what to do. Now, granted, if you're just starting, I know in Journey Collab spent a lot of time having stakeholder conversations before launching. And a lot went into those ethics. There are other companies who have done some version of that, maybe not as much. And there's some companies who maybe they're just waking up to that now. And even for psychedelic therapists themselves or people who are making a smaller clinic, it's not a huge company with a board, but maybe it's a clinic. What is the appropriate way in which to reach out to Indigenous leaders to ask for participation and consent in a way that has real reciprocity? How would you advise doing that?
Absolutely. And I think this is really important that you're highlighting this, because I think that there is definitely issues that arise when you have this reciprocity approach that is mainstream now. I think it's really great that we are wanting to give back and thinking about how we bring Indigenous peoples into the conversation. But there is a part of me as an Indigenous advocate that is worried, because there are issues that arise when there are folks asking you to hand over Indigenous peoples, right? Or asking to have access to Indigenous peoples who may not have the right education or tools and how to advocate for themselves. And so I think that you get into a place of, like you said, tokenism, right? Finding the few Black or Brown or Indigenous voices in the space to represent diversity, whether that's on your board or on your team. So I think it's important to identify who's already doing the work, right? Based on the medicine that you're working with or the space in which you're operating in. And that can start at a local level. Let's say you're here in New York City and you want to start a business around plant medicine, around Indigenous, you know, traditions and ways of knowing and being. Protocol in our community, an Indigenous community, is to recognize whose land you're on first. And then you need to do the research around those folks and those people. Understand if they are still doing their own traditional and spiritual ways in that community, how you can support them. Research the local organizations, whether that is the urban programs or the tribal programs, depending on where you're at. You can also show up for those folks while doing that research, right? Through donation, really ensuring that those folks are coming into community with you through consultation, whether you're wanting to, let me pause right there. Because I think that a lot of research needs to happen first, like I described, looking into whose land you're on, looking into who's doing the work, who are the key leaders, who are the advocates in the community, and then going to them and asking those advocates, what is the appropriate way to come into community? I think you need to do the education beforehand. And then when it's time, you reach out and ask, depending on where you're at, what medicine you're using. And I think it's all going to vary. And I think these are a lot of really great questions that people are asking themselves and are asking other, you know, voices in the space. But I think that before anything, asking yourself whose land you're on and how you can support them.
That's really important. Mm-hmm. And I think with all of these things, it takes time. There's this wonderful expression, I believe it comes from a book called Move at the Speed of Trust. You may be starting late, but you still shouldn't rush it. It isn't about trying to get somebody on your board. It's about, okay, well, if you started late, if you haven't done that, what has been missing so far in the company? And if you're starting a new company, I love what you pointed out about taking care of the people around you. So for example, are you familiar with Sage Institute?
I am.
The clinic in, yeah.
They're great.
Yeah, so I really like the work of Sage Institute, and I lift them up a lot in my conversations about the psychedelic community, because foundationally, they are a community clinic with the goal of providing equal access to ketamine therapy and, of course, other medicines as they become legal, but also training clinicians from diverse backgrounds and also doing research that focuses on different communities that aren't typically the focus of psychedelic research. When I think about a psychedelic organization that is in good reciprocal relationship, Sage really comes up a lot. So yeah, I really appreciate the work they do there.
I do too. And it was really great to visit with them and be in community when I was in town, I would say maybe a few months ago. That's just something that doesn't have a price, community. And it's so important to be ground in community voice. I think that is the way in which the Urban Indigenous Collective operates. You know, we launched in 2019 and we launched on Indigenous Peoples Day, and our goal is to become a community health clinic. But we wanted to ensure that first we planted the seeds to grow the trust. So launching on Indigenous Peoples Day with a community health needs assessment that asks, what do you need? What's working for you? What's not working? I think it's important that we don't come into community and tell community what reciprocity is and what reciprocity looks like or what programming they need or what resources are going to be good for them. We ask them, we have dialogue, and we develop that together. And so it's really exciting to be in year two of, with UIC, and now we're doing our community health forums, again, to really strengthen that relationship. Strengthen that trust. And as you said, time is so important, especially when we are trying to really repair harm that has been done as it relates to healthcare and mental health, especially for Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. And so I think that we put the seeds in the ground when the ground is ready, not based on a calendar date. And it's important to know that when you're wanting to be grounded in community voice, when you're wanting to really look at equality, those timelines are going to take a little bit longer versus just trying to get to market, right? Or just trying to profit. But again, if we think about the seven generations, when we take our time, when we create trust, when we center community, the foundation that we have will really take care of us. And I think that is something that does not have a price. And I'm willing to take as long as it's needed to be able to support my future generations and my community.
I love that. You know, I'm going to give a little shout out here. If you are listening and you are wanting to create a psychedelic clinic in New York City, and if you're working in New York City, then there's an organization that I think would love to have a conversation with you about potential collaboration and reciprocity, and that is the Urban Indigenous Collective.
Sutton,
are you open to, I mean, let's talk about like a direct involvement. If someone is in the New York City area, are you someone that they can reach out to if they're interested in collaborating, supporting some of these Indigenous initiatives and really connecting and integrity in that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We really center community-based participatory research. It's very important to us to make sure that Indigenous people's ways of being and knowing are being, you know, centered in research and the development of businesses that arise from our traditions and ways. And I think that the Urban Indigenous Collective has a really great set of expertise as it relates to culturally appropriate approaches and methodologies. You know, we have a really great staff that's Indigenous-led as well as an Indigenous-led board who all have been advocates and leaders within the United Nations or within what we call Indian country. So we would be happy to be in community, have those conversations and find a way in which we might be able to show up for each other or provide some education.
I love that. I love that. You're such an expert at these things because just the way you describe that invitation, I was like, yes, we're open for this conversation and to see if we can both show up for each other. I just, the way that we speak about things is so important, you know?
Absolutely.
And yeah, I appreciate that. Okay. So we're shifting gears. I want to talk about the individual psychonaut, him or herself, mm-hmm. their self. Themselves. Anyway, I have personally experienced so much healing and growth through my experience with psychedelics generally, just a sort of psychedelic fun experience that suddenly turns into a powerful personal growth moment, to actually sitting in Indigenous ceremonies. I sat with the Bwiti people in Gabon in Africa and did an initiation with Iboga in a very traditional setting. So I've personally benefited a lot. Someone like myself, what does reciprocity look like for me? You know, I do work in the psychedelic space in the sense that I do a psychedelic therapy podcast, and there's ways that I'm cultivating reciprocity in my professional life. But just in my personal healing journey, one thing that I want to get at here is that I think that reciprocity is part of the healing, right? Mm-hmm. We take these medicines that allow us to glimpse these beatific visions that we are indeed all one. And in that, there's like the secret of the healing, which is mm-hmm. it's this isolation, this individual atomized lives that we lead that are part of this scourge of mental health illness. So reciprocity is not just a responsibility as the recipient of these transformational medicines, but also part of the healing itself. So from that perspective, I'm curious what your advice is to fellow psychonauts like myself who would like to be in deeper relationship and in deeper reciprocity with the lineages from which these powerful medicines have come.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because you separated it out. You said on an individual way, how do I show reciprocity? I do it in like my business and my work. but you are all one. And so this conversation right here is reciprocity. Your willingness to invite me, an Afro-Indigenous voice of the Menominee United people, to share my knowledge, my teachings, my ways, to share my voice. That is reciprocity. You're using your power and your platform to bring another voice up. You're raising another voice up. And so I see that as reciprocity. And my advice to others is to look at the way in which you have power in your life. How you have power may be resources. Maybe you have more money. You have more access to money than most people. And so you show up for people by donating, by supporting your local grassroots Indigenous organization or the tribes in which your house might be built on. I think that's a way in which we can really look at decolonizing. You know, decolonizing really is looking at the unbalanced power dynamics in which we have and how we can create harmony in that. And so I think that, again, going back to how you're showing up is right here in real time. This is real reciprocity. This is what it is.
Well, and like real reciprocity, mm-hmm. it's this beautiful building of gifts back and forth. As I mentioned at the start of this conversation, this is for my audience, but it's also for me personally.
Right, because it's relational, because it's not transactional. This is relational. And I think it's important to understand that reciprocity is relational and not transactional. We're having a conversation because it feels good for us. We learn from each other. We enjoy visiting with one another. And that's what Indigenous peoples call it. We visit with one another. And from that, we're giving and receiving. But it's not, hey, Sutton, I want you to come on my platform because I want more numbers or more visibility. It's, hey, I enjoy your work. I enjoy your conversation. I enjoy you as a person. Let's have a dialogue and share it with community. That's reciprocity.
And also, in addition to I enjoy your work, we need your work. Mm-hmm. Like specifically in this moment, we are in a window of time right now where the psychedelic movement can be different.
Yeah.
And it's always been different because psychedelics are weird. And that's what's it's great.
That's right.
It's a weird thing to do, to just, you know, have visions and throw up. And it's a weird place. And to have that be shoehorned into an extractive capitalist model, sanitized into a medical system that treats symptoms rather than people, we have a chance to change that. And so I think that the work that you're doing is extraordinarily important. I love what Journey CoLab is doing. Are there others in the space that you'd like to shout out to, that people whose work we should be looking at, books that we might want to be reading, leaders that we want to be checking out? Can we talk about some of the people that are also holding this torch right now?
Absolutely. I would say River Styx Foundation have been in deep community with a lot of the different peyote people, whether it's the Native American Church or different organizations on the grassroots level. They have really been doing some really great work to ensure that conservation and the protection of peyote is being supported. And so they're working on the Indigenous Medicine Conservation Fund, which is really exciting. Miriam Volat and Cody Swift, they are just really great folks in the space. And I think if there are questions around what reciprocity means as it relates to peyote, then those are the conversations you should be having with those folks. And I would say, you know, a really great book to read right now would be Decolonizing Wealth. You already named the other book I would recommend, which is Braiding Sweetgrass, but Decolonizing Wealth by Edgar Villanueva is really a beautiful book that really shows us how we can use money as medicine. And I really think that that is something that the space needs, as so much wealth is coming in to support these transformational medicines and technologies, how we can use that medicine for healing. So I would really encourage folks to really check out Edgar Villanueva, Decolonizing Wealth, and the work that the River Styx Foundation is doing.
Beautiful. And for you, Sutton, mm-hmm. how can we follow your work? As you know, your career just seems to be really taking off at the moment, as it very well should. You're definitely stepping into a role as one of the key leaders in the psychedelic movement writ large, which is wonderful, and you very much deserve that. How can we support you? Where can we follow you? Tell us all the places that we can participate in your journey.
Absolutely. And no pun there. On the Journey CoLab side, you can follow us at at Journey Collab, whether that's on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. On the Urban Indigenous Collective side, www.urbanindigenouscollective.org. And we're also on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook at just at Urban Indigenous Collective. And then on the Shock Talk side, that's at Shock Talk on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook as well, all the social media platforms. And then just on the personal side, if you want to check me out on either Instagram or Twitter, it's just at Sutton.King.
Well, and we'll have all of that in the show notes. Because that's a great thing. We got show notes. I don't know how many people look at the show notes. I don't know
if
how
do,
often the show notes are used.
Let's get connected in the virtual world and hopefully...
I even do timestamps on my show notes, but I have no idea if anyone ever looks at that. Because, I mean, when I'm listening to a podcast, I don't look at that. But anyway, it's there.
Just in case, right? Better safe than sorry.
Well, Sutton, it has been such a pleasure to get to know you through the collaboration of this podcast. And of course, as we've discussed, I'm excited to have you on the Psychedelic Therapy podcast, the other podcast that I do, where we'll get even more into kind of the nitty gritty of the psychedelic movement and what that means for psychedelic therapists. So really looking forward to that. And yeah, it's such an honor to be here with you today. And I know my audience are deeply grateful for your wisdom and your sharing. So thank you so much.
Well, again, I just want to thank you so much for having me on and just, you know, having this dialogue. It's so important to have these safe containers where we can really just talk about the things that are on our hearts. And I think that's the part of the space that we need to keep, that heart space. And so thank you for leading that.
Wonderful job.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.